All right, good afternoon and welcome everyone. I see we're still having folks join here, so let's just take another minute or two to make sure everyone signs in all right.
Jay, I believe that is correct, that everybody is muted. Set me.
All right. Well, it looks like our the number of people joining us stabilized a little bit. So thanks everyone for coming today. We're really excited to present this webinar as part of LEAP for us, town hall webinars on new measures, changes to the survey, and so on. This is actually a really exciting opportunity for us. We have Cindy with us today, Cindy Brack, with ARC. She's a senior healthcare researcher at ARC, where she works on the research and development of tools designed to deliver healthcare services to vulnerable populations. And so that's a multifaceted role, but today she's here to talk to us specifically about the resources that ARC made available around informed consent and actually how those intersect with some of LeapFrog's new optional question set around informed consent. So that as you're going through that question set, hopefully this presentation will help you understand how those intersect with published tools out there. So just a couple reminders about the session. So we're asking that if you have questions, you put them in the Q&A. As we noted in the chat, your lines are muted. You can feel free to use the Zoom chat function just for reporting any kind of technical issues you might be having. We'll work on those. And then, of course, I should say at the end of this call, we'll make the slides and the recording especially available on our town hall calls page website, as well as a list of resources that Cindy has compiled so that you'll have sort of direct access to those. And I'll actually turn it over to Cindy.
Great. Thanks very much, Jean-Luc. Are you seeing the town hall call reminders slide?
Yep, that's right.
Terrific. So we just want to encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation. You can click on the Q&A icon at the bottom, put the question in there, and I will try and answer them at the end of the presentation. If you're having any technical problems, please use the chat function. And this session is being recorded, and you will get copies of the slides and access to the recording, as well to a sheet of resources that I've put together. So don't feel like you need to be scribbling madly to capture things as I discuss them. So we're going to cover a lot of ground today. I'm going to start out with a personal story of informed consent and then discuss the modules that the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality had created called Making Informed Consent and Informed Choice. And drawing on those modules, going through LeapFrog's standards on informed consent, the policy, the discussion, the timing, the form, and continuous quality improvement. So just to start off, want to, you know, get on the same page that when we talk about informed consent, we're talking about giving patients and families an informed choice. And informed choice requires clear, unbiased information about all options, the answer to what happens if I do nothing, and options that align with their goals and values. And we'll talk about each of these a bit more, but you know, it's important to keep in mind why we're doing this improvement work. And unfortunately, informed consent is often treated both by clinical teams and patients as a nuisance or a formality. And there it's been documented that even after signing a consent form, patients often don't understand the terms of the informed consent, the benefits, harms, and risks, the possibility of poor outcomes, and that they have the option to say no. And that's why informed consent has been one of the top 10 most common reasons for medical malpractice lawsuits. So as I said, I want to start with a personal story. And this actually happened while I was working on the informed consent training modules. My father was then 88 years old. He had prostate cancer, and he was in the hospital for a procedure. And the surgery went well. But afterwards, when he was trying to empty his bladder, which was a precondition of his going home, he had difficulty. And during that time when he was trying, I noticed that he was having trouble finding words, that he sort of, you know, wasn't speaking fluently as usual. So I alerted a nurse, the stroke response team was called, and in a flood of young residents came and started doing an assessment. And, you know, a few minutes later, they're starting to roll him out of the hospital room. So I asked, where are you taking him? And they said, to the ER, to give him TPA. And I said, but I haven't consented to the, this is medicine to bust a clot if that is causing a stroke. But we had not talked about this. And they said, this is an emergency, and kept on going. Well, that did not sit well with me. So I said, I haven't consented, and you're not giving him anything until I consent. So they kind of backtracked and said, you're right. Why don't you come with us? And we all walked down the hall to the elevator together. And they told me, you know, they had assessed him. He'd had a stroke. He needs this medicine. And we have to get it to him very quickly. There's a limited time period. There's a 3-hour window from the onset of symptoms. Need to rush to get it. And I wasn't sure he had had a stroke. I had seen these symptoms before when he had a bladder infection. I knew he was very scared if he couldn't empty his bladder, that he was going to have the catheter reinserted, which was very painful to him. I, you know, knew he had thrown up his lunch, and, you know, there may have been other reasons for this problem in this elderly man. But they said we were going to stop and get a CT scan. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, then we'll see if there's a stroke there. And so it took a while to get the CT scan, but when they were done, they said, yeah, the results were negative. We can go to the ER and we'll give them the TPA. And I said, excuse me, you said it was negative. You didn't see a stroke. And they said, oh yeah, we wouldn't have expected to see a stroke. We were just checking that there wasn't bleeding in the brain. So now we need to give them the TPA. So I was totally thrown, and insisted on calling my mother to involve her in the decision. And she wanted him to have the medicine. So he did get the TPA within the 3-hour limit, but barely. And shortly thereafter, he had a couple of seizures. And it turned out he had bled into the right side of his brain. And that night he was shaking uncontrollably. He didn't appear to understand us. He couldn't communicate at all. And since then, this is a story that I actually wrote up as a Narrative Matters article for Health Affairs, because I thought about how do we do this better? The first start for that would have been to listen to my concerns. Why was it that I didn't think that he had had a stroke? And to ask the families to share their expertise. I mean, I knew things about my father that they didn't know, and they didn't ask me. And they did not review all the options. There was an option of not giving him the medicine, and they treated it as if this really wasn't a decision. We just need you to consent. Didn't help me understand really the benefits, risks, and harms to him. Or check that I understood anything, which I wasn't understanding a lot because I was, in a very stressful situation. And I think during the frenzy of trying to minimize the door to needle time, that they just thought, we don't have time. And the fact is, there was time to engage. They could have been talking to me during the stroke assessment, telling me what they found and why they thought he had had a stroke. We had lots of time during the CT scan for them to ask me, what I understood, how I would be thinking about making the decision, depending on the results, even communicating to me what the CT scan would tell us and what it wouldn't tell us, whether, I wanted to involve anyone else in the decision. And then afterwards to check in with me what, was important to me and my family. So, as I said, I was working on some training modules at the time this happened, which makes me all the more passionate about them. There are two modules because we know that to have successful quality improvement, you need leadership support and you need a prepared workforce. So there's one model for leaders aimed at the C-suite or risk managers. And other executives. And there's a module for healthcare professionals, which teaches actual skills to the clinical teams. And both of the modules are available from the Joint Commission on their learning management system if you are affiliated with the Joint Commission. And you can get free medical education credit for taking them. Otherwise, you can get the modules directly from me to run on your own learning management system. The modules use some of the standard adult learning methods, video recordings, knowledge checks, interactivity, and they give you examples of what good looks like in terms of forms, in terms of a conversation, and a lot of resources and stories. So I'm gonna go through LeapFrog's questions, but not necessarily in the order that they're posed. So the first one is about the policy. And they ask, does your hospital have a written policy that describes the informed consent process and has it made it available to all roles and staff levels involved in the informed consent process? And this is something that we talk about in the leaders module. So we talk about the different components of a policy, including all of this, the purpose of it, who can obtain informed consent, when, content, documentation, et cetera. And then we have a informed consent policy worksheet. So it can help you work through each of those elements of the policy by asking questions that you might want to address in that. So we pilot tested the training modules with a few hospitals and a number of them found issues around the policy. And in fact, when the Joint Commission did an audit of their, looked over their audit results, because they were a subcontractor on this project, and they found that the most common audit issue around informed consent was not having a written policy. One hospital discovered that their policy was not as clear as they thought it was. There was a lot of confusion about who could hold the informed consent discussion, and you know, was it residents, were physician assistants allowed? And they ended up updating their policy as well as their general consent form. Another hospital discovered that their policy wasn't being followed. In one instance, there was a large surgical group that was not transmitting the signed forms before surgery. And so they had to resolve that with that group. And they also discovered that people, although they had interpreter services available, people were not necessarily using them appropriately. And so they needed to do some retraining. And that is something that the leapfrog questions get into more. So the second question asks whether your hospital has a training program on informed consent that tailors training to different training topics and staff roles, and whether you've made training a requirement for onboarding for new staff, and whether you have trained existing staff that were previously on board before the training program. So again, this is something that we discuss in the leaders module, talking about the different roles of informed consent, and have a matrix here for addressing staff informed consent training. So the different roles are the different columns, and the different training elements are the rows, and you'll notice who should get trained, you know, in what. So that could help guide you in your policies around what kind of training to provide. The third question asks if you have a list or a defined set of guidelines so everyone knows, you know, what tests, treatments, procedures require informed consent. And that is one of the elements of the policy worksheet. So, so some good resources for you in addressing those first three standards. There are a number of leapfrog questions about the discussion itself. So they start out by talking about prior to the discussion, do you identify preferred language? And do you offer an opportunity for a care partner to participate in the discussion? This second question you can imagine really resonates with me, since had that hospital done that, we would have saved a lot of time in involving my mother earlier. At the first one, where I mentioned the pilot hospital discovered that they had an issue. And this is something that we talk about explicitly in the leaders training. This is the leaders training. Because we know that it is a leader's responsibility to make sure that there's adequate language assistance and that there's a process for determining what people's preferred language is, to inform people that they have a right to a free interpreter, and to provide bilingual staff who have been certified as being able to provide services in other languages than English, or staff that had been trained as an interpreter or qualified medical interpreters. And in the healthcare professionals module, we talk extensively about working with interpreters. This is not something that we naturally know how to do. And so we have a lot of do's and don'ts about how to communicate with patients with limited English proficiency. So I'm not going to delve into this detail, but just let you know that this is a major component of that training. So LeapFrog has a number of questions that speak to the content of the discussion. So, you know, does the clinician explain all of the treatment choices, expected difficulties, recovery time, pain management restriction, the rationale for the test treatment or procedure, and their experience in performing the test, because we know that that affects the quality. Where people who do more of a procedure are usually more skilled at it. So this is the heart of some of the training in the healthcare professionals module. You know, we emphasize that you need to cover all the options, including doing nothing. You have to be neutral. You know, all too often informed consent, it looks like we recommend, you have this procedure done, and here's why, and here's what to expect. That is not neutral. We want to acknowledge uncertainty. Tell them, very specifics about, what they should expect, and not be vague and use subjective terms, because when you say very likely, maybe you mean 95%, but maybe you mean 60%. And the balancing of information, so both the positive and the negative, and recognizing that not everybody is going to understand when it's presented as a particular way, so using more than one way. So for example, with percentages, people very often have difficulty with percentages. So you could say 16% had this complication and 84% did not. But you could also say that means 1 in 6 patients got this complication and 5 in 6 did not. And even show them a picture that helps bring that home. All these different ways of communicating that information is going to increase the likelihood that people will understand. And remember, people are sick, they don't feel well, they're stressed, there's all sorts of things interfering with their ability to process that information. So LeapFrog asks whether or not high quality decision aids and patient education materials are used to inform decisions when procedures are scheduled in advance and there's an opportunity to do that. And in the healthcare professionals module, we talk about high quality decision aids and why it's important to use them. It can help if a clinician is going through the decision aid with the patient, it can help them structure their conversation. And research has shown for high quality, that's really important, decision aids improves patients' knowledge about what their options are and increases the accuracy of their expectations. A good decision aid also clarifies what matters most to the patient, because it asks them questions about, what kinds of things would upset them the most, or what is the most important. So, is it most important to get back to work soon, or is it most important to avoid, a bad outcome that won't affect them for many years? Is it, are they going to feel badly if they didn't do everything possible, or if they did too much and had a lot of unnecessary tests and treatments, And when that gets fleshed out, then they can weigh the options based on their values. So using high quality decision aids makes it more likely that they will actually make a decision that's consistent with their goals and values. And they're better able to cope with the treatment outcomes, whatever they are, even if there are adverse events. So part of several of LeapFrog questions asks whether or not the patient has the opportunity to ask questions. And I actually double down on this. I don't think it's enough to give an opportunity to ask questions. I think you need to encourage questions, because there are a lot of reasons why patients might not ask questions. They might think, oh, you know, there's no time, doctor's so busy, you know, I just even can't, you know, think straight, there's too much information, I can't remember, you know, the clinician isn't even listening or doesn't care. And so we can encourage questions. I mean, part of it is just showing them, inviting them with your body language, you know, leaning forward and looking expectantly and not interrupting, which, you know, we know that clinicians tend to interrupt patients within a few seconds of when they start speaking. And not waiting till you give them a huge amount of information and then ask at the end for questions, but ask for questions at multiple interviews. And the language that you use to invite questions, you know, you can say something like, I know I'm giving you a lot of information. Let me pause here so you can tell me what questions you have. Because if you say, do you have any questions? Chances are they're just going to shake their head. So Leapfrog question 11 is about whether clinicians use the teach-back method. And the teach-back method is a way of verifying whether someone understood something you told them. So you ask for them to describe in their own words what they understand. And in this case, what will be done, why it will be done, what are the risks. Basically, any information that you want to make sure that they understand, you should use the teach-back method. And we have an extensive section on the teach-back method in the healthcare professionals module. It gives a lot of conversation starters, because sometimes it can be awkward when you begin, how you do the teach back so it doesn't feel like a test, which is very important. So I actually am going to be doing another town hall with Leapfrog on September 21st, and I'll be going into depth on some of these strategies that I'm breezing through a little bit today. So timing. Leapfrog has two questions, two standards about whether or not your hospital shares the consent form at least 3 days in advance, and whether your hospital discussed the consent form with the patient at least 1 day before. And then, you know, this is super important, because once a patient has taken time off from work or school, is in the hospital, even has an IV in their arm, you know, they're not going to feel like they have a choice. That is not the time to have the discussion. That is not the time to go over the form. It needs to happen earlier. And, you know, giving the form in advance also allows an opportunity for them to discuss with their loved ones, you know, the decisions that they need to make. So I'm going to move on now to the form. And questions 6 and 7 of the standards speak to the content of the form. So Leapfrog wants to make sure that your forms include the elements of consent, and that they've been covered, the name of the clinician, whether the clinician is expected to be absent, and if any assistants or trainees are going to be involved in the test, treatment, or procedure. And another standard is whether or not the consent form is written in plain language and at the sixth grade level or lower. So my next you know, set of slides is going to be about the form. And to remind everyone that a signature on a form does not provide legal protection. In fact, complex consent forms have been the basis for legal action. And, you know, the Joint Commission has acknowledged that the typical consent form is unreadable for any level reader. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in their conditions of participation, state that informed consent requires a patient to have full understanding, this is not the best language, to which he or she has consented, and authorization from a patient who does not understand what they're consenting to is not informed consent. So really, really important. And you know, we think that the responsibility for creating a library of clear and simple consent forms is sort of a central one. And therefore we include it in the leaders module, and want to make sure that hospitals' forms, as Leapfrog said, you know, cover the tests and treatments requiring that. But, you know, some people think, oh, you know, the form isn't that important because it's just the documentation. The important thing is the discussion. And while I agree absolutely that it is just the documentation, that the discussion is at the heart of making informed consent and informed choice, it can be a roadmap, a well-designed form that is in plain language, where there's a logical flow of information, where the information's broken out into sections with informative headings, where there's a clear layout, lots of white space and bullets and not a, you know, cramped, dense thing, can help the clinician having the discussion go through the important parts of informed consent. So I also want to speak directly to the sixth grade or lower requirement. And the unfortunate thing is that most informed consent forms are written at 10th or 12th grade or higher. And yet the average reading level of US adults is 8th to 9th grade. So that means if you have a document at the 8th or 9th grade level, it means half of them will not be able to understand it. So 50% is kind of a lousy bar to be shooting for. And that's why the 6th grade level is a much better goal. And I will be very honest with you, it is really hard. I mean, one of the most humbling things I ever did was trying to develop informed consent form for a toolkit that ARC has on research consent. And it is hard, but you know, even if you get it to the sixth grade level, 1/5, 20% of adults are still gonna have difficulty. And that's why I, you know, never give a form to a patient and rely on their being able to read it. You know, you have to have the discussion. So I'm going to go through a few examples just to see what it can look like. And this is actually an example from the work that I just mentioned on the research consent. You know, before, this is pretty standard language. It said, your participation in the study is strictly voluntary. You have the right to choose to participate or withdraw your participation at any point in the study without prejudice to your future healthcare or other services to which you are entitled. And we ran focus groups in English and in Spanish, and found out, you know, people don't even necessarily understand voluntary. You know, this language is not clear to people. And then we tested the language on the right. You don't have to be in the study. It is your choice. Your choice will not change your regular care in any way. And that people understood. They got it. I can be in the study, I cannot be in the study, it's up to me. Wanted to show you an example from a health system in Iowa, the Iowa health system, who had done some informed consent improvement work. And this is where they started. As you can see, it's a quite dense document. And, you know, there's this urge to try and fit everything on a page, or if you've got to be in two pages, then, you know, just cramming it all in as short as possible. But short is not often, you know, better. And, you know, just a really high reading level. And they worked with a group in their state called Iowa New Readers. And these were individuals who were attending adult basic education classes and who partnered with them to, you know, telling them what, you know, what would work for them. And they came up with this form. So you can see it's two pages now, but so what? You know, there's a lot of white space, things are chunked out. I love this section on the left-hand side, which with the blanks here, that's where you can write in the teach back. Like, you know, it's a way of kind of certifying that clinicians are actually using the teach back method because they wrote down what the patient said that they understood about this. And you can see, you know, there's a checklist here on the right hand side of, you know, that we talked about all of these things. So you know, not a perfect form, but huge improvement. There probably is no such thing as a perfect form. Here's another example that's from a guide called A Practical Guide to Informed Consent. This is not an ARC product, but I really recommend it. It speaks to, you know, hospitals trying to improve informed consent. And it spends some time on actually improving the consent forms. So you can see the annotations of how they show, you know, what it was and what they did to improve it. And here on the signature page, you can see everything, you know, it takes some room. So what? You know, just giving that space. And one thing which I love about this one is at the bottom on the right here, you can see there's room for the interpreter to sign, which is a very important piece of the documentation. So you can know that, you know, with your patients with limited English proficiency, an interpreter was used. So the final section that I'm going to share with you is about the questions on continuous improvement. At least once a year, the LeapFrog standard asks, does your hospital solicit feedback from patients, guardians about the informed consent process, so that you can understand how it can be improved? And do you do a complete audit of informed consent process to evaluate its efficacy and provide feedback to staff on future opportunities? Because we all know that, you know, it's not a one and done affair, that you really need to continually improve and to get the data, the information to help you make those improvements. So I am going to end with this cartoon that we use in the informed consent training modules that illustrate that just asking a question, offering two treatments is not offering a choice when you can't understand it. So here we have Humpty Dumpty's doctor who says, okay, you can choose regal equine therapy, I can't even say it, or fragment adhesion cranioplasty. So, you know, you could have all the king's horses put you together again, or, adhesion, yeah, we'll glue it back together. Just a light note to end the presentation. I have flown through a great deal of information, and I've violated the principles that I've laid out in terms of not waiting until you've covered lots of information. But I now really want to spend, we have plenty of time to talk about the questions. So I am, going to try and swap my display screen so I can see your questions. Hold on a second more. Working with two monitors. And there we go. I've got to get the mouse on the right one. And swap, and I thank everybody. I do see that there have been a lot of questions put in here. So I'm going to open that up. So we have been trying to get our consent forms from into a sixth to eighth grade level, currently at 12 plus. Are there samples, and or can someone who already dropped the reading level to the standard share? So great question. So I will humbly say that I do not believe that the samples that we have for the ARC Informed Consent and Authorization Toolkit for Minimal Risk Research quite get to the sixth grade level. But it gives you a look at what these can look like and some language that you can use that's simpler. Similarly, that practical guide to informed consent has some examples and also teaches you how to get there. And I just saw today on a health literacy listserv people asking the question, talking about the leapfrog standards and saying, does anybody have any samples that they could share? So if some are shared on that listserv, I'll be sure to share them with Jean-Luc and the Leapfrog people to pass along with you. But if you do have samples that you can share also, even if they're a work in progress, enter it in the Q&A and we'll make sure to circulate them. So the next question is, what you're presenting is shared decision-making. Informed consent is legal, requires that it's different from state to state. Some are state-based, some are patient-based. How does your training interface with a variety of requirements? Second question, I'll ask that, I'll read that too. Isn't it time to start training patients to engage in shared decision-making? I'm thinking CMS should do this and pay patients to get trained. Really great questions. And so for those of you who aren't familiar with the different state standards, these are legal standards to judge whether or not informed consent was adequate. And one uses the sort of, reasonable patient standard, would a everyday patient tend to understand this? And the other uses a sort of state of practice, is this what is commonly said for informed consent in your profession in the state? I argued for unbiased disclosure, but I really need to put my biases out front and center. I don't care if it's common that if your state uses a physician clinician standard. And you can say, as a defense, well, yes, this is incomprehensible, but everybody does it, so too bad. That to me is not where you want to be. You want to make the consent understandable to the patients that you're serving, and the patients that you're serving will have different skill levels. And as I say, in the moment, whatever, they can be very educated, very smart, and still have difficulty understanding things if they are complex at a time where they're vulnerable. So we, in the training, we don't deal specifically with the different standards. I hope that I'm inspiring you to even go past your state standard if you're in a physician standard state. And yes, you know, you are absolutely right that this is shared decision making. And shared decision making, I mean, again, trying to be transparent, I really believe in patient and family decision making, and that the clinician's role are to help me make an informed decision. And so they have the expertise in all the medical stuff. I have the expertise in me, and you know, together we can put those together to reach a decision. But you know, that two-way street, you know, most clinicians are not trained in shared decision making. And so in the healthcare module, health literacy strategies, shared decision making strategies are being taught. You know, how to present choices, how to engage patients and family, how to help them come to a decision. Yes, it is shared decision making. The interesting point about training patients to engage. So I think that, you know, there are different preferences for shared decision making. And there are some people who say, you know, just tell me what to do. But there's also some evidence that some of the people who say, just tell me what to do, say it because they don't think that they're going to understand well enough to make an informed decision. I'm sorry, my voice is losing me. And that's our job, to be able to make it clear enough and to help them understand. And in a survey I once saw, low-income Californians, when they were asked, you know, did they want to engage in shared decision-making? And then they were asked, well, what if the information was clear and easy to access? Many of those who had initially said, no, I'm not interested, switched and said, oh, in that case, yeah, I'd like to participate. we have a number of other questions. I'm so sorry. Strategy number 8, working in the operating environment, decision aids prior to surgery are rare since the surgeon is the one who is scheduling from outside the hospital. How can we improve this gap? I would wager 5 out of 6 patients do not get this data, especially when it comes to elective surgeries. So I love this question. So what can we do? Well, can you identify high quality decision aids, have a library of them, share them with those surgical groups who have privileges at your hospital. Tell them that, you know, it's a requirement that you know, patients who have surgery in our hospital get to see these decision aids, and engage in a conversation with them about what would help them use that. Let's make it clear that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be the surgeon who sits down with the decision aid. Maybe that can be another member of the clinical team, and then come back to the surgeon for the actual questions and the informed consent discussion. So it is, you're always going to be trying to encourage the best behavior, even though you have limited levers for influencing those outside clinicians. Does TeachBack have to be documented in the patient's medical record, or is it going to be just be a checkbox in the medical record, or not in the record at all? So that depends on your facility, and you know, it will be a decision that you will make. So, you know, I know that in some hospitals, TeachBack is required as part of the discharge education. So, you know, there are 3 parts of the patient education, and here's what you have to teach, and here's where you put in the medical record that you've done TeachBack. you know, on that form that I showed you where you write it in on the consent form, you know, that would demonstrate and document that you've done the teach back. You may need to, you know, have some observations of, you know, occasionally people walking around, observing discussions, is teach back being done? How can the nursing staff help support that, you know, you know, that there is a requirement from the Joint Commission about communication. And so that might be an area if you have a place to document how you're complying with those requirements to put that in. The word anesthesia is above the sixth grade goal, so very difficult to be compliant with this. Yes, and one of those examples that I showed you said anesthesia and then defined it. So whenever you gotta, you know, use a piece of jargon or a medical term that people don't readily understand, explain, you know, this is going to be something that helps relieve pain and relax you or kind of put you to sleep or, you know, depending on what kind of anesthesia it is, you know, medicine that we'll give you, you know, in your arm and you breathe in or, you know, whatever it is, describe it. And so when you're kind of, you know, if you're using those machine readability testing tools, you could take out that word as long as you've described it in plain language for the testing purposes. But ask yourself, is that word essential? So I think anesthesia probably is, but sometimes we say, oh, you know, hypertension. It's like, you don't have to say hypertension. You can say high blood pressure. Just think it. Will an easier word suffice? So I'm looking through the questions and Jean-Luc, I saw with one of them, you had said, you know, answer live, but other ones I don't see. So if there are other ones that you particularly want me to answer, please point that out to me or even unmute yourself. So could a decision aid be at a lower reading level document to share the consent and that process? So I'm not quite sure. I mean, yes, we want that. I understand the question. Yes, we want decision aids to be at a low reading level. That does not replace the need for the consent form to be at a low reading level as well. You're asking me to sign something, you know, in a legal document. And if I don't understand what's on there, we have a problem. So you need to, you know, explain the hard words, break it down, have somebody go over it with me and check that I understood. You know, I tell people in patient education, never rely on people reading things that you give them or send them on the web or anything like that. With regards to the timing of the consent, in the hospital environment, it is difficult to ensure the consent is obtained days prior to the procedure when the patient typically does not arrive at the hospital until the day of the procedure. How have you been successful in changing this practice at hospitals where the physician is not an employee? So, and again, if I didn't make it clear, I am not a clinician. I do not work as a hospital. So I am a humble person who is, basing her knowledge from the hard work of others. But, you know, like the example that I gave on the hospital that pilot tested, one of the hospitals that pilot tested the training, they had a requirement that those signed consent forms be submitted to the hospital before, you know, I think it was a week before for some procedures, the procedure. And so, you know, if those forms weren't in, you were not supposed to allow them to operate. And, you know, you could set up a system. First of all, talk to your surgical groups. Don't just kind of heavy-handed, you know, try and get them to be partners. And how can we get this to work? We need to comply, blame leapfrog, blame joint commission, whatever. We're being pressed to do this. Can you help us do it in a way that so that it's not going to be onerous to you, but that we can make sure that this is happening. And we know you're our stars. I'm sure you're doing this all right, but we don't know that everybody is. And so let's see if we can establish a process where we have a way of checking that everybody's on board with this. I like to point out that, doctors have privileges at your hospital. And I know that, you want the doctors to use your hospitals and not go to other hospitals, but there's some negotiation that happens there in terms of what you need from them as well. What modules are question 15 and 16 covered in? They are in the leaders module, where there is a part of the policy that taught, when you're developing your policy, part of your policy is, how often are we going to revisit this policy? How are we going to improve it? It is not an in-depth section, so I don't want to mislead you, but it's part of thinking about, what is our policy going to look like? And one of the things that we did when we did these training modules is we gathered some data. So we did some surveys of clinicians, of leaders, and of patients. You can, use a short, brief patient survey at for a week or whatever to get some feedback, making sure that those surveys are easy to understand. What do you find the most challenging question to fulfill and why? Very good question. I think it's about the content of the discussion and moving away from informed consent being, I'm trying to get you to agree to this treatment that I think you should have, to the mindset of, there are a number of possible things that we can do. Here are some of the options, including you could decide not to do any of these things. And really, do that shared decision-making thing of letting patients know that it is their choice. I think that's the hardest. Is it necessary to explain to a patient every remote possibility for a complication during a medical procedure? So you should really talk to your risk management people, or maybe this is a risk management person asking me this. But basically, my position is, if you give me a laundry list of 20 possible things that have a one in a million chance of happening, that is not informed consent either. That is just muddying the waters. And you need to communicate, here are some things that are unlikely, but sometimes happen. These things are rare, but they're really serious. So, you might want to consider them. And then there's some things that just almost never happen, just listing every little thing makes it actually a meaningless process. And it's, excuse my language, but a sort of cover your ass approach of saying, well, I told them that anything could happen. So that's, you know, don't talk to your lawyers too. The area on consent that is required to state that the doctor will not be performing a part of the procedure, does this need to be in the body of the consent? Does the physician need to be present for this part to the patient? So this is not something I have expertise about. And maybe Jean-Luc, you guys, you know, have some thoughts, since that was something that you highlighted in your standard. I will tell you from a personal perspective that, you know, when I was having abdominal surgery, I looked at the consent form and it said, you know, oh, there may be some trainees. And I very specifically said, you know, I think I'm perfectly fine to have trainees watch as long as it doesn't slow down the procedure, but you're the surgeon that I selected and I agreed that was going to do the surgery, and I don't want them doing the surgery instead of you.
And just to quickly jump in, since you asked,
yes,
the question specifically is asking about the content of the form, the way we phrased it currently, not necessarily specifying whether it needs to be the physician and themselves presenting that information to the patient. So I just want to make that distinction there. So it's a one, but not the other, Lois.
Right. And so, you know, in terms of taking a team approach, you know, you could have somebody else on the team go over certain parts of the form, et cetera. It is only the person performing the procedure or test or surgery that can actually do the bulk of the informed consent discussion and get agreement. And, you know, we want to eliminate instances where, you know, a clinician hands a form off to somebody else and says, go consent the patient. You know, that's what we want to get rid of. How is my father? Thank you for asking. So interestingly, my father did recover. He was in the ICU for a few days, and then he got his language back. He got his was able to communicate, had memory, etc. And so the neurologists were all delighted. They just thought this was this huge success story. But what they didn't realize is, you know, he'd spent several days in bed and he lost hugely on mobility and he started having falls. And we also think that in the years subsequent that he had some, you know, a bunch of minor strokes, that his cognition went down over the years. And so, you know, it did have a major impact on his life. He ended up living to almost 94, the day before his 94th birthday. But, you know, it shows you a different timeline of how patients and families think about outcomes and clinicians, because for them, they were like, we got the TPA in, he's, you know, he's now talking, he's, you know, we saved him. And I don't know how bad it would have been if he hadn't gotten the TPA, but, I see we are at 4 minutes after the hour, and they've removed all of my questions. So I realized that I did not provide my email address. So Jean-Luc, I don't know if you can add that to the handout that I sent out. Somebody's already promising to contact me. I really hope that you feel that these tools are useful, and I will be back on September 21st to dig into some of the health literacy strategies and the shared decision making, and look forward to engaging you all more then.
Yes, thank you so much, Cindy. So I'll put your email in the chat as well, just so folks have that real quick. Yeah, so it, exactly. Thank you so much for presenting today, Cindy. We got a lot of good feedback in the chat. I hope you saw that too. And so, yeah, so just, we're getting a couple questions in the chat. So, yeah, so the slides and recording will be posted sometime tomorrow, so you all can access those. And actually just the same webpage where you access the town hall registration link in the first place. But thank you so much. And also, I should say too, if we didn't quite get to a question, or there's a part you want clarified or something like that, you can feel free to reach out to LeapFrog's help desk. Many of you know how to do that already, but it's just at helpdesk@leapfroggroup.org. And we'll be happy to answer that question.
Yes, and I apologize for not answering questions that were in the chat as opposed to the Q&A, because I was focusing on where they told me they should be. But we ran out of time. And again, you know, hopefully this has been helpful.
All right, great. Well, thank you, everyone. That concludes today's webinar.